It's 21-1366, Nicole Thompson versus Scott Renner et al. Oral argument, 15 minutes per side. Ms. Olson for the appellants.
If I may, thank you, justices. We're here today to discuss the proper role of the federal court as it relates to interpreting state court practice. Every day in thousands of courthouses throughout the Sixth Circuit, attorneys such as appellants represent their clients pursuing recovery of unpaid obligations. Every time they file a complaint, every time they serve a pleading, every time they file a motion or propound a discovery request, every time they step into a hearing or a trial, they are juggling a long list of state and federal laws, procedural requirements, and in some instances, jurisdictional issues. In doing so, they have to not only be apprised of the law as any practitioner, but they must be mindful of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, an act which has in recent years been scrutinized a great deal more by this honorable court. Each time an attorney such as appellants receives a case, they must determine the proper courses of action to assert. They have to determine and calculate the appropriate statute of limitations. They have to determine the proper venue, whether the court itself has jurisdiction. Ultimately, they have to determine what facts they have to prove their case and what they will ultimately be forced to prove in the case. Like every attorney practicing in any area of the law, collection attorneys have the same duties. They must research and analyze the law. They are subject to the standard of bringing claims that have not only factual support, but legal support, or an opportunity after appropriate discovery and inquiry to prove the claims they are making. They do this while zealously protecting their clients' rights. However, for those attorneys that practice in the creditor's rights sphere, it has sometimes become an occupational hazard because in addition to carrying themselves at the highest level of pleading and in accordance with the rules of professional conduct and the pleading guidelines set forth by a particular state court, they always run the risk that if at some point in the proceeding their good faith belief turns out to be wrong, or maybe not even wrong. Maybe a court simply takes a different view of a case or a different view of the issue. They now have the specter of liability. It's a specter that very few attorneys practicing have. It is unique to the creditor's bar, and it is that very intersection that this case implicates. The facts aren't complicated. I don't want to rehash my brief, but I do want to point out that the position that appellants have taken in this particular case is supported by several binding decisions of this honorable court. In this case, appellee alleged that the appellants, a collection attorney and his law firm, sought and obtained a writ of garnishment on an out-of-state corporation. It is that simple act of obtaining a garnishment against an out-of-state corporation, which forms the basis for this particular suit that we're here today for. There have been no separate allegations of the normal variety you would see in a Fair Debt Collection Practices Act case. No claim that the debt wasn't owed, no claim that there was improper, harassing, abusive treatment. At the end of the day, the case rises or falls on this court's interpretation of where the proper line is. We know, and this court has said time and time again, that merely coming up short or being wrong is not the standard. In fact, in the Van Hoven case, which was recently decided by this court, the justices there took great lengths to determine where do you draw that line? Is it true that every time an attorney makes a contention about law, in this case about jurisdiction, and that turns out to be rejected by a court, is that in and of itself enough to find liability under the Act? We know it isn't.
Well, counsel, was this an error of law? I mean, did your client think there was jurisdiction for some reason?
My client thought there was a basis, a reasonable basis, as signed off in the affidavit, to believe that jurisdiction could lie. There's no dispute. The garnishee not incorporated in Michigan. There are two other ways under Michigan law that jurisdiction can be found, either through consent or through continuous and systematic interactions within the state of Michigan.
And did your client have a reason to believe that there was that consent or the interaction, the activities in Michigan?
Yes, Your Honor, and that is why appellants signed off pursuant to MCR 1.109 that they had a reasonable basis to believe that.
I may have missed this in the record. What were those bases?
In terms of what they knew when they knew it?
Yeah, well, either the activity or the consent. What was your client basing that on?
They were basing it on the fact that this particular health organization, not only is it geographically in proximity to the state of Michigan, but even a cursory review shows connections to Michigan. There are Michigan residents working at the hospital.
Does the record show where it was located? And you've now said that it was located near Michigan.
Yes, it's based in Chicago, Your Honor.
In the record?
Yes, I believe it is in the record.
Was it presented to the
court? In the statement of facts, it was both sides conceded that the garnishee in question.
Did you argue this in your brief? Because I was looking in the briefs for anything that might amount to this kind of allegation. I didn't see. Is this a new argument now you're making on it?
No, it's not a new argument. In terms of the briefing, we did outline that there was a basis to believe that.
What was there anything in your brief that would show that there was a basis for belief? That's why I'm confused.
No, in the brief, Justice Rogers, we point to the fact that that assertion was made in the affidavit supporting the request for the writ of garnishment. And that affidavit was never refuted in the district court.
Maybe you could tell me where that is in your brief.
Yes.
But I don't want you to search it now. Maybe on rebuttal you could point that out very quickly. Thank you.
Yes. We do assert, Your Honor, in the brief, I'll get the page citation for you if you'd like it now or in rebuttal.
However you want to present it.
That's fine. You've only got a little bit of time left on
it. Yeah. But the point I want to emphasize, and I want to answer all questions that this panel has, is that there is a process under the Michigan court rules for requesting these writs. An attorney, as an officer of the court, makes certain assertions in requesting these writs, and these assertions are subject to review by the state court, as a state court would have the authority to review any filings or representations made to the court in pleadings or in arguments. This wasn't simply a circumstance where the ministerial act of getting the writ was accomplished in a vacuum. It was not. In fact, the Michigan court rules very clearly outline what the standard is to obtain a writ of garnishment.
And well, but it was ultimately discharged by the court for lack of jurisdiction.
Yes, it was. But that does not, Your Honor, respectfully, that does not transform the request itself
No, you're quite right. It doesn't.
Into a false statement.
Some indication that, it's just some indication that he didn't have the support. Okay, I think we'd very much like on rebuttal to know what you're relying on.
Certainly.
Both for that and for the consent.
Okay.
Certainly you could have a case where maybe there was a typical garnishee who typically consents and you assume that he will again. That's a lot different from just finding somebody who owes the other party some money.
Certainly. Thank you.
Thank you. You'll have your rebuttal.
May it please the court, Michael Nelson for the plaintiff appellee. There's a distinction drawn in the Harvey case, which is also followed in Van Hoven, which we've cited, and that is between a pleading or a position taken by an attorney that comes up short because of failure of evidence or maybe a position of law, of arguable law, that ultimately fails. That is not a violation of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. What is, and those courts are clear about this, is a position that is a statement that is entirely baseless to start with. And that's what we have here. That's what the district court very clearly held, that there is no way that the plaintiff in the state court could have thought that there was jurisdiction over the Illinois garnishee. That was the holding of two of the state judges, both the district court and the circuit court, both as a matter of statute. The statute in Michigan governing garnishments requires jurisdiction over the garnishee, and as the circuit judge held in Michigan, that's also a matter of elemental due process going back to International Shoe. As a matter of fact, the defendants here never even argued in the state courts that there was jurisdiction. Their only argument was that maybe the garnishee had waived the objection to jurisdiction by not timely objecting. Now, even if that's right, that doesn't justify their action in taking an illegal collection action. This is like the...
In creditors' rights cases in general, I'm asking you not a legal question or a question in the record, but you could tell me if you litigate in this area, do garnishees accept consent when they don't have to? Is it?
Well,
why not? I mean, the money is owed, and they owe, and they're paying it to someone else. Why not consent to the?
Why not consent?
That's the nature of my question.
I can tell you what happened here, Your Honor.
I'm not asking you what's happened here. I'm saying, what could you sort of think the norm might be?
I can't tell you statistically. I can tell you it goes both ways. If a garnishee thinks or is advised by counsel that they don't have to honor the garnishment, I think they probably won't. Although they might not actually ask that question.
I'm not saying that they have to. Might they just do it as a matter of course, just in the good of the public, that debts get paid? They don't do that, is what you're saying. Or you don't know.
They might. They might. I mean, the person getting the garnishment is not an attorney. It looks like it's a valid court order. It's very likely that they may not inquire as to whether they really have to make that determination. The reason they did here is...
I'm asking more that they may not care.
That's true. Okay. Although it is something that it's an administrative burden of some amount that they have to do. They have to calculate the amount to turn over. Does the court have other questions? I know that the appellant didn't get to very many points in the brief. I responded to the one. This, again, is not an interpretation by the federal court. It's not a hard one. Like I said, two of the state court judges made this determination, said it was not proper, and that there was never any basis.
But that really isn't what's dispositive. We know it wasn't proper, but the question is whether it violated the act, and just being wrong doesn't get you there.
That's right. And it's true that not every violation of state procedure violates the Act. The question was answered, I think, in Currier versus First Resolution Trust, which where the court said the proper question is whether the plaintiff alleged an action that falls within the broad range of conduct prohibited by the Act. This one does. It falls squarely within 15 U.S.C. 1692E, which includes threat to take any action that cannot legally be taken or is not intended to be taken. And the court held in Currier and also in Stratton that the taking of an action, the threat to take an action includes actually taking that action.
Would there have been a way to establish personal jurisdiction here?
Sure.
The mere fact that the garnishee is out of state doesn't mean that there can't be a garnishment action under the statute, correct?
The proper way would have been to file an action in Illinois to domesticate the judgment. They could then proceed.
I thought the statute permitted consent to jurisdiction.
It does, but there is no way at the outset for a plaintiff to assume that that will happen. And it didn't. This, I think, is like just like the cases that talk about filing a time-barred lawsuit. And that is, yes, there's a good chance, particularly against unrepresented defendants, that the defendant will default and waive the objection to the statute of limitations. So you can get away without. But that doesn't make it proper to start with. That doesn't get you by the rule that whatever burdens the FDCPA puts on debt-collecting attorneys, the burden here is no different than any other attorney, and that is you must know at the time that you file a lawsuit or take any other position, there must be good grounds to think that it's likely that there will be evidence to support it, not necessarily that you have it, and that there's at least an arguable position, a legal position, that you're correct. And that was just not present here.
Unless these things are normally consented to, then you might assume that
well,
it's going to be.
You know, I think that same argument could legitimize time-barred lawsuits.
Yeah, okay.
I haven't looked at the, well, I have, as a matter of fact.
Well, I don't know. I think someone would have a great incentive to plead time bar because they're the defendant. And if they plead the time bar, they'll win their case. Whereas these people, all they're doing is sending the money to the what is in fact the correct recipient.
But if you look at
the difference, there is a difference, isn't there?
If you look at these debt collection lawsuits, 90% of them are default judgments. So your odds are 90% that if you file a time-barred lawsuit, you'll get away with it because probably the defendant will consent.
They consent
or
to a
will,
case
will
that's
waive
time.
The objection. You can waive statute of limitations, certainly.
I'm not seeing what the logic of doing so would be. Why would you consent to something that causes you to have to pay if the law doesn't require it?
Well, that's
other than through negligence or laziness or incompetence or something like that.
You know, that's a question that the Michigan Supreme Court has a panel actually looking into. We don't know, but the fact is that people who are sued in debt collections most of the time do consent, maybe for a number of reasons. They don't think they can afford a lawyer, don't know how to proceed, whatever. Statistically, they do.
Well, if you're talking about a real consent judgment as opposed to a default judgment, they consent because they get a break. I mean, if a negotiated consent is usually, there's a pay schedule and they get a break. But I'm not sure that a default is a consent. But I think Judge Rogers was making the observation that it could be quite possible that garnishee defendants consent because they don't care who they pay the money to. He's asking because you practice in that field.
What they did here was they responded. They answered the interrogatories, provided personal information about Ms. Johnson, and they filled out the form to calculate how much money should be forwarded and said, we're going to do that. I don't think that's the same as consenting. I mean, they
At what point, what should have happened here in order to obtain a consent?
Well, I suppose it's possible that the plaintiff could have contacted the garnishee and said, here's what we're proposing to do. Do you consent to jurisdiction in Michigan?
So why wouldn't it be reasonable to think that if they sent the garnishment paperwork and the garnishee cheerfully filled it out, sent it back, and didn't say, hey, go away, you don't have jurisdiction over us, that that would be consent?
Well, once they were informed there might be this issue, they decided not to honor the garnishment.
Well, the garnishee defendant, but it was the...
That's correct.
It was the debtor who filed the motion, right?
The debtor filed the motion, but in the meantime, the garnishee had said, we're ready to send you the money. Once they were informed that there was an issue about jurisdiction, they did not do so. They did not proceed. So it looks like once they knew about this issue, they, for whatever reason, decided not to consent.
But the case really comes down to what the collecting lawyer thought, not what the garnishee thought.
Excuse me, to what the collector thought.
If the collector thought, oh, this guy will probably consent, then he probably, and had good reason for thinking he'll probably consent because it makes no difference to him, then you have a weaker case than if it's the same thing as a statute of limitations where no thoughtful defendant would consent.
Well, first of all, that was never argued below. The defendants never argued, we had reason to think, whether it's statistical or whatever, probably we would have consent.
Okay, so I'm going to ask opposing counsel when she gets up whether there's anything in there that suggests that consent might be forthcoming. That's the right question, though, right?
It was not argued below. There was nothing presented to the district court to indicate that they had a reasonable belief that there would be consent.
Okay, thank you.
I think that I've answered most of the arguments in the brief. I don't want to repeat that. If the court has any other questions.
If they did have a reasonable belief that there would be consent, then you lose. No, let me rephrase that. If you have a similar situation where the lawyer had reasonable belief that there would be consent, is that a defense?
I think that they would need more than just the possibility that this might happen. I think they need something to indicate that maybe there's a connection between the garnishee and the state of Michigan, maybe doing business, or for whatever reason, there's some reason that they probably would consent. I think that's what the defendants here would have to show.
So supporting the belief with a factual basis.
Yes, and that factual basis should have been brought up if there were such a thing in the district court.
You wouldn't have to bring it up if you wanted to consent. You just consent.
Well,
whoever makes the decision asks his boss or her boss, do you want to object to this or do you want to consent to this? We don't have to, apparently. And the boss could say, why not?
Well, again, I think consent.
We like our whatever it is, the people we deal with to pay their debts. You don't have to have a reason that has to do with whether this company was located in Michigan or not, or did business in business or not, in order to have some sort of plausible reason to consent, do you?
Well, we're talking now, there's two things. It's not just a question of do we consent to honor garnishments. It's do we consent to jurisdiction by a Michigan court. In other words, could we be sued on any claim in Michigan? Because
all you have to do is consent to this particular garnishment. You don't have to consent to every garnishment in the future or every lawsuit in the future. You just say, okay, we consent to pay this garnishment.
That's true, Your
Honor. You've already, I think, agreed that, you know, there might be reasons why you do that normally or why you don't, but none of those reasons depend on whether the garnishee did business in Michigan, because consent is independent from whether you...
That's true, but one thing, I think there are two different things. I think just deciding, well, we like to honor garnishments is not the same thing as saying we like to be sued by Michigan courts, at least this time.
That's certainly true, yeah. Two different things.
Thank you.
Thank you. The question I'd like to address first before I go on, there was a joint statement of facts record docket 36 that was jointly submitted by the parties, jointly stipulating that the garnishee was an Illinois hospital. We do speak to that. In addition, the question was...
I'm not sure what the relevance of that is.
Well, Justice White had asked if there was something in the record as it relates to this being an out-of-state corporation.
You said it was very close to Michigan.
Yes, that characterization is my own. I apologize if I misunderstood your question, Judge White. I thought there was some question as to whether there was an agreement that this is not a Michigan corporation, and that is not in dispute.
Well, that isn't what I was curious about. I was curious about the idea that there's some basis for the lawyer to think that there was jurisdiction in Michigan. And you said, well, they knew that the company was located close to Michigan, suggesting that if you're right on the border, you probably do some business in Michigan, and maybe you reasonably thought that it had contacts with Michigan. Is there anything in the record which shows that?
There's nothing in the record.
Nothing in the record. Did you argue anything like that?
And no, and the reason being, on a Rule 56 motion, appellant's affidavit stood unrefuted. It was not their burden.
Okay, so what was in the affidavit? This is what we're trying to get at.
Yeah. The affidavit indicated that there was a reasonable belief that this garnishee had funds.
What is the page ID number of the affidavit?
I have the affidavit as
We can find it, but you...
Yeah, I apologize. The affidavit, and I apologize...
Okay, I'm sorry.
If I've misinterpreted... The affidavit is contained in the writ itself.
Okay.
Which is... Yes, Judge.
That was my question. Is this the affidavit that was submitted to obtain the writ that you're talking about?
Yes, Justice.
Okay. Was there an affidavit in this case?
There was not.
From the lawyers explaining why they reasonably believed that there was jurisdiction?
There was not, Your Honor.
Okay.
Notably, in the federal district court, appellants took the position on a Rule 56 motion, with discovery not concluded, that the existing affidavit, absent any argument, any countervailing affidavit, had to be taken at its word by by the district court judge because there was no factual development one way or another.
Okay, so the affidavit with the writ. And what were the words in there that you are relying on?
I am relying upon, it's not the words in the affidavit, is it's a form. So the words are already created in the court rule, which is MCR 1.109. There were no specific averments made. The affidavit itself that accompanies the writ simply indicates that there is a judgment that remains unsatisfied and that the garnishee that has been named is believed to have funds that are subject to the garnishment, and that the affiant, or in this instance, the attorneys, have a reasonable belief that they not only have these funds, but that they are subject to the writ of garnishment. There's no representations about jurisdiction.
If we accept that argument, doesn't that mean that any establishment that has an ongoing obligation to pay the person who owes you money, you can just garnish them and then worry about whether there's truth? Maybe it's a retirement fund in Texas or something they want to garnish. They can just say, just send them that affidavit, just like you've got. And that's enough?
May I
sure,
respond?
That's the question.
I see my time is up.
Oh,
yeah. May I answer
the question?
Yes.
Judge Rogers, as you indicated, it may very well be that the garnishee has no objection and does in fact consent. And this is in fact how the garnishee responded here. So at the end of the day, this doesn't leave consumers without a remedy.
Okay, so this is the core of it. Your position, your legal position, is that the possibility that a garnishee will consent is enough to make this procedure permissible?
Not the mere possibility of it, no. There are other ways to show jurisdiction, but absent an opportunity to do that, consent is merely one. And there was no factual development. In fact, in the state court...
Counsel, we're not talking about doing business in Michigan. We're focusing on... We know that they're not a Michigan corporation. There's no indication that they do business in Michigan, right?
There are facts that...
They're in Chicago, right?
And they have Michigan residents working at the hospital that we know of. There are practitioners who are working...
I don't think that would fly. I really don't. You've got... Okay, so we're left with consent. And what you answered, the answer that you gave us is that there's always the possibility that that pension fund in Texas would respond to the rent and thereby give consent. I thought that was your answer. I may have misunderstood.
There's always the possibility they will do that or not do that.
Okay, and as I understood you, you were saying... And so that signing that affidavit is okay.
It is because it is the court rule that governs whether that's okay or not. And if it's not, the state court judge is in a position to make that determination, not a federal court judge a year later. There was no finding.
But we're talking about a federal statute that places limits on what a debt collector can do, and maybe those limits are beyond what the state imposes. So ultimately, the question is whether that's enough, whether that possibility is enough to defend against a lawsuit like that. And I'm trying to pin you down. Is it enough?
It is enough at the time it's made to meet the standard of reasonableness. It's not objectively unreasonable. It may be a tough paddle, but it's not on its face objectively unreasonable. That's the position we are taking. Another judge could have seen these facts in a totally different light, particularly in light of the garnishee's disclosure and willingness to remit these funds pursuant to the garnishment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Justice.
I'm sorry.
No.
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
The case will be submitted.